Right on, right on. Thank you, Andrew, for that. I don't know if you guys know that was his voice right there. As Jen said, I'm Jeremy. So if you don't know me, hi, nice to meet you. My wife back there, hi, nice to know me. Today we're continuing in our series of Shape of the Kingdom. And every time I've been up here in the last few times, you guys have kind of got a little idea. My brain sort of works in this world of music. And when I first started coming to this church back when it was Ventura Vineyard, Bob Harper used to start off every sermon with his own joke, you know? I figured out maybe my little niche thing is this kind of music trivia thing. So we'll kick it off with that for today. I titled this message For What It's Worth. This is maybe a big reach for it. How many of you know the song For What It's Worth by Buffalo Springfield? All right. Okay, what if I say the whole, you know, stop children, what's that sound? How many of you know the song now? Okay, perfect. So that's the song. Exactly. So this kind of ties into why I titled this and put this there. The story behind this song, when Stephen Stills wrote this song, when he went to show it to the record label exec guys, he was basically, I wrote this song for what it's worth. If you like it, you can have it. He played it, they liked it, and then when they were ready to put it out, he's like, well, it doesn't have a title. And they're like, yeah, it's For What It's Worth. And it's like, oh, no, that's what I was saying. So that's how that went on. But the other reason I my mind went to this song and that whole trivial thing as I was putting this together is the book that we've been using to go through these Beatitudes is by Larry Warner, Beatitudes of Jesus. And he's talking this deconstruction, reconstruction story. Now, in this particular chapter, going along with the verse that I'm doing today, if you want to go to that, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For the same way they persecuted you, for the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. I can read, I promise. So going along with this, in Larry Warner's book, and the chapter kind of going along with this story, he really kind of puts it into a personal account, kind of telling his experience with this stuff. He really ties it into religious trauma and some of the things that he went through. Now, jumping back to the song thing that I brought on, when Stephen Stills wrote the song For What It's Worth, that song in particular was written about, sounds kind of silly to call it this, but the Sunset Strip riots. It happened in 1966. Anybody of you around here in Southern California during that time? All right. Well, what was happening at that time, they really cracked down on these clubs and stuff down on the Sunset Strip. They started putting out curfews for underage people, and all these things were happening. There's even a really bad kind of B-movie thing that was made, Riot on the Sunset Strip. I think the Standells did a song called that and everything, too. But for all it's said, it was kind of a smaller thing. That, you know, guys got out with signs. Peter Fonda, Jack Nicholson, those guys were out there protesting this stuff, and the cops maybe kind of arrested some people, but it wasn't this big, insane riot and all that stuff. But the words that Stephen Stills wrote, they carried more weight with them, even though they were talking about this specific event. That song with lines like, let's see, there's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right when everybody's wrong. Young people are speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. What a field day for the street, 1,000 people in the for the heat, 1,000 people in the street. These lines that he wrote in the climate of the day, this song got really swept up and pushed as an anti-war song. Most of us who have heard it and recognize that song, think of it as like, oh, this was really going against the Vietnam War and everything that was going on. It's like, no, he was just mad he couldn't go to shows. But but so with that whole idea, I'm picking up where Larry Warner kind of led on this today, and I'm going to present my take on this verse by telling you guys sort of my own personal story. And as I go through that, we're talking about insult, and you know, I'll say some things about religious trauma myself, but I have to put the disclaimer out right from the beginning. If we're going to call it religious trauma or anything like that, in my instance, it's definitely religious trauma light, all right? I realize that I speak from a place of privilege, and I don't, for the most part, come from a marginalized group that really got hit with a bunch of things. But my hope is, as I've walked this faith journey, and I tell you kind of this path that I came up, maybe my story, just like that song from Stephen Stills, can kind of connect to something deeper, and maybe it can have a bigger meaning that you can connect to. And so if you have experienced some really heavy things coming up through the church, or even opposition as walking the Christian faith and opposition from the outside, the examples I give might seem kind of silly and light, but I hope that it taps into something deeper, and I hope that the Spirit can speak through that. So cool? So this is going to be my story for what it's worth, all right? Okay. So the next disclaimer before I jump right into it, as I tell my story coming up through this, it's not just going to be I was a Christian and I got insulted by it. There are plenty of times where I was the victim, yeah, but there are plenty of times that I was also the perpetrator. There are times that I was the agitator, I was an instigator. Most of the time, it's a little bit of a combination of all of those things. And you'll see right from the beginning when I kick off that sometimes I wasn't getting opposition for being a Christian. I was just getting opposition for being stupid. Or looking silly, or however you want to go with that. Now, my personal story starts here, and some of you will relate to this. If that Bible looks familiar to you, then you may be a child of the late 80s and the 90s and that kind of stuff. But I got saved, if we want to put it that way, at a young age. This was the days that you prayed the prayer, and that's how it went. And I can't tell you how many times I prayed the prayer. I know as a little kid, I have a distinct memory being at Wagon Train Camp at Hume Lake, which is this really cool thing where you're a little kid and you get to go sleep in covered wagons. And I remember I must have been 8 or 9. It would coincide with whatever year Go West by Michael W. Smith came out. So I remember one night at Wagon Train, our counselor was... before we all went to bed, he's reading the Bible for us, and we're all going to go to bed, and he's reading through Revelation. And I remember as a little kid thinking, this is not the coolest thing to be reading to me. And so I probably prayed the prayer like 4 or 5 times that night, like, Lord, don't let this all happen to me and everything. But leading to that Bible, I got saved at that young age, but as the years passed, something happened. I always kind of put it in this light, though. My mom started getting headaches and decided she was going to stay home from church on Sundays. And then to me, it was like, oh, wait, this is an option? Like, we can stay home? This is cool. So I started staying home through those elementary school years a little bit, hanging out with my mom. But then when high school came about, going into high school, I'm a child of the Central Coast, or not Central Coast, Central Valley, and we would go over to the Central Coast to go to the beach there. I grew up in a tiny town called Farmersville, but our big city that we live near is Visalia. So there you go. But so being a Central Valley guy, I somehow fell in love with the ocean when we would make these trips. And I started deciding that I was a surfer, even though I was actually a bodyboarder. And then as I got into high school, it turned out our church does a beach camp. And I was like, well, I want to go hang out at the beach for a week, so I better start going back to church. And so I know these people. And that put me right smack dab into youth group culture of the 90s. And that is when I really, really kind of started following this. And I would have been digging through that exact Bible, reading all of the study stuff on the side notes and everything. And that's where it kicks off. Now, before we move on from here, I'm going to tell this story in four different sort of sections. Now, these are sort of overlapping. It's not chronological. And they're going to seem really silly as I lay it out for you. And sticking with the whole preacher thing, I definitely went with the alliteration. So you guys are going to hear these four things that really shaped who I became, starting with, number one, punk rock. Number two, purity culture. Number three, pacifism. And number four, patriarchy. So we're going to jump right into that first one. Punk rock. My hero, Joe Strummer, said, in fact, punk rock means exemplary manners to your fellow human being. Now, a lot of you probably don't think, if you know of punk or you think of punk, you don't think of it in these terms. But when I grabbed onto this in my early youth, this was sort of the movement that was taking me. You can go to that next one. I saw an overlap of these ideas. I was a Christian, but I also saw where Paul's saying anyone who claims to know all the answers and doesn't really know what as they ought to know, I'm hearing bands like Operation Ivy saying, all I know is that I don't know nothing. And I'm like, this is it. This makes sense to me. And I was grabbing on to stuff that was preaching unity. There was this idea of you stand together, you take, it was grassroots. And I grabbed on to a lot of music and stuff that, even though aggressive and wild and going crazy, it was also preaching this idea of peace and standing against these oppressive systems, right? And so now, while that might not be your idea of punk, for most of you, it probably looks a little more like this. So there's baby Jeremy in my punk stages. Now, full disclaimer, my mohawk got much bigger than that, but I wasn't such a wild dude, because I have to let you know, my mom used to help me iron up my mohawk with the, I would put it on a table and spray, and my mom would take an iron and iron it out, and it would stay up for 3 days, and it was a whole thing. Yeah, it's really silly and all that. But the other thing that was happening, though, you know, keep in mind, while that was me right there, I was also at my own little high school, the president of the Bible Club. So there was a little bit of a duality that was coming up in that time for me. Now, with this, there were a couple different spaces that I met opposition. As I go through each of these parts of the story, I want to kind of indicate where opposition came from inside the church and where opposition came from the outside. Now, as I mentioned, at that time when I had the mohawk, I was doing the whole thing. I was playing in a band. There was also, in that time in the early 90s, there was a big movement in this weird cultural phenomenon called Christian punk, which was kind of odd. And there's some trauma from that I'm outgrowing still today. But there was a big movement of that, and there was this thing where we got thrust into, I started playing in these bands, but then we had this scene about us, and we would play at these churches, and in some ways, that was kind of my first little dipping my toe into preaching. It was sort of this thing like, okay, well, if you're going to make music, you also, it has to be a ministry, and so I always felt a little conflicted, because that's not how I wrote songs. I really, that's something I've always done, is write songs, and I could never just be Jesus this and Jesus that. I could never write worship music or anything. I was more of a storyteller and all that. And so right off, I felt a little uneasy within our own scene. But then from being in the youth group and all of that style, it was really funny, because I was really loving the Lord and trying to follow and all this. But there was also this tricky thing. I would have my friends' parents who would tell my parents, you know, they knew the name, right? So they would be like, oh, my dad's name is Herb. They'd say, Herb, oh, we hear great things about your son. Jeremy, we hear great things. This is awesome. He seems to be really loving the Lord. That's great. And then they would go tell their kid, I don't want you hanging out with that kid with the mohawk. He doesn't. And it's like, and the wild thing is, like, my friends who were like more clean cut, they were like stealing the car and running off to Vegas and doing stuff while we were in high school. So So for a lot of it, I was kind of getting a little bit of slack for looking crazy, but I was actually, as my wife will attain to now, a real goody two-shoes and wasn't doing anything that wild. I remember specifically our youth group used to do Wednesday nights where we would meet at houses. And I remember stopping off with my mom to grab something to eat at Carl's Jr. before I went to the youth group. And there was another family in line in front of us with their kids, and the mom, or she was behind us. And the mom is sitting there telling her kids, like, look at how ridiculous he looks, like saying all this stuff. And my mom, if any of you ever get to meet her, is a very spunky woman. And I remember I'm laughing because I hear them talking trash about me, even the way I look. And my mom says very loudly, yeah, if they only knew that we go to the same church and we're headed there right now. And it's like, oh, my Lord, this is crazy. But so that kind of stuff did happen. There was also an instance where, you know, being a musician at the time, I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, maybe I should play guitar in the worship team at the youth group. And every once a month, our youth group would do a youth Sunday at the big church, right? And they would take all the kids would put on the church service. And so I auditioned, quote unquote, for the youth group band. And what's really funny is within the youth group at that time, there were maybe two or three of us that played guitar, and it's not a brag or anything, but I was the only one that actually knew how to play guitar. And so the other guy, a friend of mine that was playing, it was pretty rough. But I was like, all right, yeah, I'll do this. And so then when they had to have a meeting with me about this, and I remember going into this meeting with the youth pastor, and it's like, we really want you to play on the worship team, but when we do the big Sundays in the big church, we're going to need you to take your eyebrow ring out and have your mohawk down because we can't have you in front of the church like that. And I remember being like, eh. The funny thing, again, I already mentioned that my mom is spunky. The youth leader's advice was like, why don't you go home and talk to your parents about that? It's like, good luck. So then we did, and we actually like read through and prayed, and the conclusion we came to is like, you know what, this is all good, and I think God's really looking more at my heart than he is at the way I look, and that's fine. I'm still going to go to the youth group. It's all good, but I don't need to change for this. And when we came back, I remember having the meeting and said, like, oh, thanks for the opportunity, but I'm not going to play on the worship team. And he said, are you sure? Do you think we should bring your mom in and talk? And I was like, no, you don't want to talk to my mom about this. So that's kind of the stuff that I was experiencing coming up. Now, granted, that's more getting a little backlash just for looking crazy. But I was, at the time, trying to really follow Jesus and walk in this way. Now, moving to the next one, not all the opposition was coming from inside. Andrew probably doesn't recognize this place, but you did mention you're from Bakersfield. This is one of my favorite places on earth. It's a little place called Jerry's Pizza in Bakersfield. And it was my favorite place to play. There's a little show of one of the bands I was in where I was singing. And the reason I bring this up, because my favorite thing to do playing in this whole punk rock scene in this was playing in stuff that had nothing to do with church, had nothing to do with Christians. It was just getting out there and like winning over crowds. And I remember playing a show at this place, Jerry's Pizza. And it was with a different band, not the one that I was hanging upside down with. But the band that went on before us was a touring band, and this band was called Damnation. I don't know exactly where they're from, but they were older than us, and they were a rad band. I remember the guys in my band were sitting there watching, we're like, oh, these guys are awesome, like, we're really into it, this is, like, super cool. And afterwards, we told them, like, dude, you guys were great, that was good. Oh, they're really nice to us. Then it's time for us to go up. We start playing, and they're, like, into it. And then the singer in my band says something about Jesus, like, hey, we just love you guys, and we just, you know, if you ever want us to pray with you, or something like that. Very, very vague. The temperature switched. And this band sat right on the side of the stage, staring at us the whole time, flipping us off, pointing at us, telling us we're going to kill you, all this stuff. And I remember being like, whoa, this is what that looks like. Now, that was more of the classic, you're living Jesus and the world's going to come at you. So that was there, and there was this space that I was like, okay, we were too loud and crazy for the Christian spaces, but then we were too Christian and Jesus for this outside thing, and it really kind of made me question, what does this look like Like, can I just do what I love and just be that and you guys respect that? Now, that whole punk thing had a huge impact on me, but let's move on to the next one. While all of this is going on, at the same time, simultaneously, I'm deciding to follow Christ, plopped right in the middle of what we would refer to as purity culture. And in the early 90s, purity culture, to my understanding, was really at a big booming height. This quote that I put up here is, as it says, by Joshua Harris. He wrote the book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye. When I was really living the youth group life, this was a big thing. And I led off with this quote. Just some of you probably have those same scars that I have coming out of this culture. And Joshua Harris says, I want you to hear that I regret any way that my ideas restricted you, hurt you, or gave you a wrong view of yourself, your sexuality, and your relationships. These views that he's talking about were this idea that you shouldn't be dating. My very limited take on youth group of the 90s is sort of this thing like, if we can get the kids not to have sex, we did our duty. And that's kind of how it felt through all that. Now, coming up in that, I'll have you know, while I was out there being a punk rocker and playing in these bands, it never occurred to me that playing in a band could get you chicks. Like, that was just not the movement for me. And so as we were going through this, and I was living the Jesus life in the youth group, being the little punk rocker guy, I had girlfriends over those times, but the environment that we were coming up in, as I'm referring to as purity culture, it really had me in a kind of a conflicted and what I see now as a shameful space. As I tell these stories, I'm just for vulnerability and reality, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to be very free with the language, okay, and all this stuff. So here we go. It's really funny to me. I don't think anybody is as concerned with the exact particulars of what constitutes intercourse as a youth group kid who's trying to, like, get things out with his girlfriend. So we were out there trying to really abide by these heavy burdens and really trying to walk the line as close as we could. Some of the opposition that I saw come up was, it came about with friends of mine. Now, I was really conflicted. I almost put this up as a slide, but I don't know the legality of it. But some of my buddies, you know, they went so far within this where you have, you know, you had your true love weights, your rings and all that stuff. But my buddies came up with what they called master bands. So they had these bands they put up to say that they were in control of their stuff. Unfortunately for these guys, we're being open. Master band didn't last for me long. I got rid of all that stuff. But these guys, these friends of mine, going post-college, a couple of these guys moved out to New York. And some, at one point, while they're living out in New York in the early 2000s, they met up with a guy, said he's a writer, started hanging out with him for a little bit, wanted to get to know about them and who they were. And before too long, an article comes out in Rolling Stone magazine called The Young and the Sexless. And it ripped them to shreds. These are my buddies. It's making fun of these guys who say, oh, and you can see in this picture on the cover, here's so-and-so with his, on his wrist is his master band, saying that he's in control of his body. And it made Christians look so silly and ridiculous. And granted, what we were doing was kind of ridiculous, right? But they were trying to walk that line. I have another friend of mine who, in trying to really wait for marriage, he was actually working as a youth pastor at the time that he was engaged. As his engagement got closer and closer, his mother-in-law tried to convince her daughter not to marry him because if he wouldn't sleep with her, he must be gay and she shouldn't marry him. And it's like, we were trying to do this. We're trying to be responsible with the information that we were given. We were trying to follow what everybody was telling us God wanted us to do. And I think in some ways, we were really being led by shame And we were, as Joshua Harris said in that quote, kind of just suppressing our view of ourselves and our sexuality and our relationships with others. So as hard as that was, there was the coming from the outside, those kind of things, even for me later, in trying to do that and slipping up and failing, there were, I won't go into details about this, but there were lies that were spread about me and trying to call me out as a hypocrite when things like Facebook posts and all that kind of stuff. But a big pivotal moment for me as we're telling my story coming out of the purity culture is as I got into my early 20s, I don't know how this really happened at the time because the internet wasn't really a thing so much then, but I finally started kind of questioning and working through certain things in Scripture that had always been uneasy for me. I had some friends who were homosexuals, and what I understood the Bible to say countered that, and in my understanding at the time, the Bible said that homosexuality was a sin, but somewhere in the early 2000s, my early 20s, I started taking in more information. This is probably around the time I probably heard the idea of the word arsenicoitis was not translated as homosexual until early 70s. I started learning just different things from Scripture that had me start questioning this. And I would say my stance as I moved on to this had really reached a place like, okay, as far as I understand, this is what the Bible says, but I have this hope that if I die, and, you know, and as I would have said then, when I die and I go to heaven, I hope God's up there going like, yeah, you totally missed it on that one. You got that one wrong. That's not at all what it meant. Now, keep in mind, I'm telling the story as where I am in that space. So at that time, as I'm starting to sort of question that and dig deeper, I'm holding what I understand the Bible to say. I'm holding it a little looser because it's not super clear on this, and I'm questioning those ideas. At some point there, I had a conversation with my dad. And I brought up these things. We're just talking about this stuff. And I was like, yeah, I think maybe it doesn't mean exactly this. And did you know it wasn't translated that way until just recent years and stuff? And my dad, God bless him, is a wonderful, wonderful person. But his views were more set in that time. And he got very upset because in his mind, I'm walking away from this. I'm being blasphemous. And this conversation escalated and escalated, and it reached all the way to the point where my girlfriend and I left the house, went out into the car, my dad followed us out, screaming at me that I was a sinner. I remember I stayed away from the house for about, I was still living at home, I was in my early 20s, I stayed away for about 2 weeks or so, and then when I did come back, I kind of decided, all right, this is, I got to get out of here. And I love, again, I don't want to paint a bad light. I love my family. But that really set me on this thing like, I got to move on. This isn't working. That moves on to kind of me even moving out here and getting here. I got a different job. I set a path for me to leave home because of that opposition. Happening also at this time is, we can go next one. My best friend went to a Mennonite school, Fresno Pacific, and he starts toying with these different ideas. And I start taking on this stuff and working through these ideas of pacifism. Now, with this, I put the quote up here by Tertullian. Tertullian is the early church father. He says, "In disarming Peter, Christ disarms all Christians." This is, along with the idea of God's view on sexuality, this idea of pacifism and nonviolence for me was something that went on decades working through this. I'm still unpacking what this looks like. But as I started grabbing onto these ideas of nonviolence and it being just undeniably woven through Christ's teachings, if we're going to talk in terms of opposition, working through these ideas were the first real, real heavy opposition I started getting from within the church. I think that's pretty much the only place I've gotten opposition. From the outside of the church, as I talked through these ideas of nonviolence, most of the reaction I got from the outside of the church is like, well, you must be like a different kind of Christian because I don't see that. But from the inside of the church, I actually had a friend of mine when I was at a church here in Ventura that I was, you know, it was wonderful, but I was working as an usher in that church. And I remember having this conversation with one of the other ushers, an older gentleman, who I love and respect. But we were talking about this, and he laughs, and he calls one of the pastors over, and he's like, can you believe it? This guy thinks you can be Christian and a pacifist. And they laughed at me. And I remember being like, okay, well, this is weird, but I'm working through it. And then we go on to, let's go to the next one. If you guys notice the date of this Facebook post that I put up there, that's August of 2020. The thing that happened at this time, which most of you remember, there was the shooting with Kyle Rittenhouse that happened. And I remember after that had happened, I saw all these different posts, either putting him up as a villain or putting him up as a hero. And I remember going to drop my son off at preschool, and we had gotten up late for the day, and I go to drop him off, and when I get to the school, everything's locked up. There's nobody there. And keep in mind, this is my 3-year-old son going to preschool. And so I have to go to the office, and when I go to the office, the lady at the office says, she's like, oh, I'm sorry, we're doing our active shooter drills, so everything's locked down. He can stay here until it's over, and I'll take him to class. So my 3-year-old is having to go through active shooter drills. Then I get in the car, already upset about that. I start driving into work, and as I come up the boulevard in Camarillo where I work, there's a line outside of the gun store for people waiting to get in. And I'm sorry, but I was just like, fuck, this is, what? What is going on? And I posted this, and this is the question as I've worked through pacifism. This is the thing that was working with me. I say, Christians, I know this is one that will stir up some stuff, so here I am being the instigator. But in recent events, this question that I've wrestled with for years is ringing in my head. It's clear from examples of the early church fathers and from Jesus himself that we as followers could be called to die for our faith. Can you find any scriptural backing, though, that we under his finished work on the cross could be called to kill? I personally don't see it. Stirring it up. There you go. Now, I could have used up a lot of slides to share the comments that came back from that. not even to mention on the one before, the little jump back, when our church, and I was so proud, but when Liminal came out and made the statement that we were going to be an affirming church, I was dumb enough to post that statement on Facebook too. And there you go. I remember that my favorite one was a pastor's wife from the church I used to go to, and I put that statement on Facebook, and the response was, this is heresy. I'm like, okay, here we go. We had a great conversation after that. It was all good. All right, moving on with this, though. So this pacifism thing, this idea of nonviolence, it's crazy to me. It seems so intrinsic in what we do, but opposition coming from inside the church, laughing at me, telling me that this is no way, calling even ideas of almost calling you out as a coward. If I believe in pacifism, what kind of husband and father could I be? If I, you know, how am I going to protect my wife? All those things. thanks, babe. So that one's a funny one, but let's move on to the last one here. Patriarchy. I put this verse, Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, I have seen the Lord, and that he had said these things to her. I put that because I see now there is no way for me personally in my understanding to oppose women in leadership roles because God seemed to think it was okay to have them preach the first big sermons. So we'll get to this. We'll get to this later. But patriarchy, the resistance to patriarchy and just my big distaste and understanding of this comes a little bit later in our story. So when Cricket and I first got married, I went to the church that I went to. She went to the church that she went to. And we both just at the time did not feel we wanted to go to either of those churches. At the same time, one of my best friends, one of the groomsmen in my wedding, had joined up with a new church plant. And we decided, you know, I think God's calling us to go with this thing. And we went and joined up with this church. And through the tough times of a brand new church plant, going through that, we moved up through this into leadership roles. We did everything. We led home groups. I led worship. I got my first chances ever to preach and really started doing this thing. Cricket helped run the media stuff in the back. She ran a dance studio out of the building. All this stuff was happening there. If any of you out there were a part of this, I hope this isn't a trigger for you and all this kind of stuff. But now this movement that we were a part of, it became very clear early on, was being led by one man. And that was the controlling, and I don't want to overdo it, but I'll say the oppressive force in this experience. And as time went by, and we went through a lot of struggle with this, keeping my wife there longer than she wanted to be, this movement was also happening in what most of us grew up in, but a complementarian movement, right? So if you don't know the difference between complementarian and egalitarian, complementarian is this idea that a lot of the evangelical churches exist on. It says men and women are equal in value but different in roles. That's how they would put with the soft complementarian view. There's this idea that men preach, women don't preach, men are the leadership, the man is the head of the household, and these ideas were just things that I was normally, it seemed normal because it's what I was brought up in, but I was uneasy with it as we were going through it, and then as I saw the example play out, where there was this man that was really kind of ruling over things, and strong women all throughout the church I saw getting pushed down, suppressed, talked down to. I know as we came to the end of our time with that church, some of my best friends had really bad experiences of the way this man talked to them. And it all came to a head for us where we had moved from place to place with this church as ties got broken with the buildings we were in. And then it reached this big thing where the church was going to be having this big meeting, and they wanted everybody to be there. And then Cricket and I were not able to be there. And we talked ahead. Here we are in these leadership roles, and we spoke to the pastors, if you want to say it in that way, and said, hey, is there anything we need to know about this meeting as it's happening? No. It's all good. Finally, my wife pressed to convince him, like, okay, we'll live stream this on Facebook so people who can't be there can watch it. All that to be said, it came up within that meeting that they were going to be moving, and we had friends that we were talking to on the phone, you know, texting back and forth with this meeting, and somebody asked the question, well, does Cricket know about this? Like, what's going on with the dance studio? Now, this was a big part of our income at the time. And this man said, oh, yeah, no, we talked about it. She knows. So they're like, well, what's going to happen? And his statement was, oh, well, we had a good run. Now, this was a full-on lie. This had not happened. There had been no talk about all this stuff. And we had already, Cricket and I, going through all this stuff, had already talked, if this is how this goes down, we're going to leave this church. We're done. We had been through so much. Backtrack just a little bit before that. I remember one time I went surfing with this friend of mine, this man, this pastor. And afterwards, he asked me how I was doing. And I was telling him that we were struggling. And I was being as nice as I could. Maybe this was another instigator thing. But I was like, I got to be honest, like, we feel like we've been in this for so long and we're getting drained, and we feel like we're not being fed. I was like, you know, you're cool, but I don't relate to your style of preaching, and we really feel like we're not being fed. And he's like, oh, no, I totally get it. The next week, he preached a sermon all around the idea of, you know who needs to be fed? Babies need to be fed. And grown-ups learn to feed themselves. These things were breaking us down. And so then, in response to that, oh, Can't look at my wife. In response to that lie that was spread, my wife is a real go-getter. She does it when things need to happen. So her thing was like, hey, we got to find a new place for this studio. She went on right away and let know, hey, we're looking for a new home for our dance studio. And we just learned about this, if anybody has any leads on this. Now, this, of course, is calling a man out as being a liar. The man in charge. And so I almost used, instead of that quote, I almost put the quote up, you need to make your wife take that Facebook post down. Because that was the voicemail that I got. Now, in going through this, this really just, it hit us in a part where I was just like, I can't have, I've walked through all this stuff. And here we are, this idea of men in control, holding people down, this is breaking me up. We cut ties with all that. And that brought us to where we are now. And this is a funny one. I keep glancing over to Ashley, too. We ended up coming over here to Vineyard as we left that. And things were great. And it's funny because coming out of a place where you had a man in control, all we wanted was, like, we want plurality. We want other people leading, not just one man kind of ruling over things. And we come over to Ventura Vineyard at the time. And there were some funny things that happened right off. Right off, one of the first days we were here, they introduced us all to the elders, and more than half of them were women. And I was like, well, yeah, here we go. But then as we came back a couple times, Bob Harper was preaching at the time, and I just remember, like, I hadn't seen it before. I had heard Bob preach, but it didn't click with me in the space that I was in before. And then we came and I heard Bob preach and I was like, wow, I love this dude. And I was stoked. Yeah, we're here. This is where we are. I like this guy. I can follow this guy. And then not too long after that, they make announcements. Hey, Bob's going to be stepping down and and we're going to be an elder-led church and there's going to be plurality. And it's like all this stuff we've been saying we wanted, now they're doing it and it's not what I want. But and then right around that time too, I'm coming out of this stuff. Now you guys, you know, like I said, all this stuff is probably light, but you've been through these things. You've felt that trauma. There's a weight that I just can't take it anymore. I don't want to deal with the church stuff. I don't want to do all this. And I remember Ashley, being a friend of ours, coming over here, came up to me at the time. They put out this questionnaire that was like, what talents do you have? What things, how can you serve? And she put together this thing, and it's like, do you play it? You know, and I didn't fill any of it out. And I remember Ashley coming up to me and being like, Jeremy, you play guitar. Do you want to play on the worship team? And my words to her was like, Ashley, I ain't doing shit. And here I am standing before you guys. So, But that leads us to where we are now. Like, so again, I don't know if any of that made sense in the context of insult and opposition, but let's move on to the next one here. This is what it opens up to me. Okay, I do believe that discipleship is deconstruction. It means something to me as we've been going through this book. You know, that Larry Warner really puts it in the context of this de-reconstruction because I got to say, I've been nervous at times here at Liminal as to, like, I don't want us to be the deconstruction church, you know? Because there's so much of this being sort of the hip buzzword and like, oh, are you going through your deconstruction? But I am assured, and I look at this idea that this is a natural process. If we're going to follow Jesus, some of these ideas are going to rise and fall. So at a time when I just accepted a complementarian view of male headship, I've said before from this very pulpit, I am a flaming egalitarian all the way. I think that for me personally, I believe that women and men are equal in God's house. As far as the idea of the purity culture and coming off of those things, I had to walk through that stuff. There was a time when I would have said, even as lightly and loosely as I held it, submitting to what I understood Scripture to say, I would have said at that time that homosexuality is a sin, as it says in those pages. Now, I loved. I had no hate or anything towards anybody, but I was like, oh, I have to submit to this. And as I've dug deeper, I've learned and found more compelling arguments that have shed that away. And with that, as I've walked through these ways, there's been opposition that's going to come. Even the punk rock thing, all that stuff, it's like I still, it's so rooted in me. I can't drop all that stuff. But I'm standing up here talking to you guys about punk rock. That's like the least punk thing I could possibly do. These things are all moving and changing. And I think that as we decide to follow Jesus, this stuff is going to fall. I put this quote from Larry Warner in this book. He says, "This process of sacred de-reconstruction, taking apart, re-examining, putting back together anew, it is a necessity for experiencing ongoing growth. It is to be experienced in one's relationship with God and your interactions with the world." If we're going to keep following God through this stuff, we're going to be taking things apart, dropping it down on the ground. We're going to put it back together in a different way. And if me 10 years ago met me now, I would probably say, you're a heretic. But I can say to you guys, I haven't stopped following Jesus. I haven't lost any love for him. I'm going to keep moving this way. Now, we can go on to the next one. Because of me. So this whole thing of like rejoice because you're in good company. You're here with the prophets. One of the things that really hits me is the prophets weren't killed by by the Philistines. The prophets were killed by the people of the church. You know, even though Rome was hanging Jesus on the cross, it seemed to be his own people that were telling him to stay up there. So we're gonna experience that. And I don't wanna just be the outsider church of like, oh, look at us, we're doing church a different way. But there is gonna be opposition if we are trying to follow Jesus as we go through this. And so I'm gonna leave you with one thing, the last thing that I'm gonna leave you with, and I hope that this is an assurance to you as I go through this. I wish I knew who to give this quote to because I heard it in passing years ago and I've never been able to trace it back to who actually said it. But let's go to this last one. On this idea of because of me, okay, I want you to think about this and maybe there's something. You're not getting persecuted. You're not going through these different oppositions just because, oh, I'm following Jesus and nobody likes it. But maybe there's this idea that Jesus himself is doing that deconstruction in your life. So this idea, God, over 2,000 years ago, he came and he reconstructed the religion that he himself started. What makes you think he's not doing it again? Everything that's going on in your life right now, there are things that you may have thought 10 years ago that just don't make sense now. I don't want to be the Christian who says, hey, this is where my faith is and I'm comfortable with this. Let's build up my walls here. And anything that moves on beyond that is heresy. We're going to realize that God doesn't fit in those walls. And I think for real, it's him that's tearing those walls down. Cool? Amen? All right.